This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Humanitarian groups often swoop in around the world to help people hit by natural disasters. Now, the U.S. Agency for International Development has launched a program to see if people can be saved before disasters. It's funding a consortium of seven universities around the world to explore those possibilities. Here with the details from the USAID's Bureau of Humanitarian Assistance, the Acting Division Chief for Private Sector Engagement, Diaspora and Innovation, Maggie Schmitz. Ms. Schmitz, good to have you.
Thank you, Tom, for having me this morning.
Well, tell us about the aims of this program, because I guess I'm puzzled by how you can save people before the disaster because they're already alive still.
We've all seen over the past several years that extreme weather events are increasing both with in terms of intensity and with frequency. So there's going to be more and more demand for humanitarian actors to react around the world. And in order to increase the effectiveness of humanitarian assistance, what aid agencies need to do is to implement the most effective early action at the right time and at the right place. And what we are talking about with this project is called anticipatory action, or action that is taken before a predictable disaster in order to mitigate the disaster's impact. And with anticipatory action, it's a relatively new concept within humanitarian aid, but there is not a lot of data that demonstrates both what is effective and what is cost effective. So if we know what sort of actions can be taken before a predictable disaster, like a drought or a flood or a hurricane that we know is coming or arising or happens on an ongoing basis, then we will be able to invest in these actions in order to reduce suffering and save lives.
So the purpose of the academic, I guess these are grants, would that be fair to say that they're going to explore what the possibilities are for different classes of disasters?
Yes. So this is one project. It is a consortium of seven universities around the world. It's headed by the Feinstein International Center at Tufts. And then there are six other universities around the world, Bangladesh, Uganda, Lesotho, Mozambique, Namibia, and the Philippines. And there are two tracks to this program. One is looking at actual events that take place and that actual actions that were taken before the onset of a disaster. And this is already happening. We kicked off the program in late 2021, but already this project is looking at actions that were taken in Eastern Africa as a result of the failure of a rainy season in Eastern Africa. So right now, there are survey teams going out, collecting the data, and they will analyze the information to say those early actions that were taken in anticipation of the failure of the rainy season, what impact, if any, did those actions have? And what is the most impactful of those actions? So that is the one track where they're working with actual events that take place. The second track, and this is really where the academic level kicks in, is that each university is heading up a specific topic with regards to anticipatory action and humanitarian action. And that includes, what is the impact of nutritional interventions with regards to flooding, or, you know, how heat waves affect urban residents, or how effective is forecast-based financing when it comes to typhoons? So that will be the ongoing research taking place over the next 2 years, in addition to the actual impact evaluations of actual events. And then throughout this entire two-year project, the universities will be writing up their research, engaging with the academic community and the humanitarian community overall across the world, and hopefully building the evidence base for what works and what doesn't.
We're speaking with Maggie Schmitz. She's the Acting Division Chief for Private Sector Engagement, Diaspora and Innovation at the U.S. Agency for International Development. And just to try to put some solidity to this, do you have any ideas? Are there any possibilities that you know of, to go back to the example of a drought, and that could cause a crop failure? So I guess hunger is the actual effect you're trying to stave off. Is there any possibilities that you're aware of that could be developed into real action plans, such as getting grain there sooner or moving people to different areas?
So a lot of what anticipatory action also does is look at how to make people more resilient to natural disasters. And like you said, the example of drought or of flooding, some of it will look at that agricultural practices. You know, are there different sorts of seeds or inputs or fertilizers that can be put into the system that will help people be able to withstand the impact of drought? Some of it will also be, again, like nutritional impact and whether pre-positioning nutritional supplies for families, the most vulnerable, before a drought or before flooding takes place. And it's always better to anticipate and do something before something happens, because that will allow you to reach the most vulnerable before there is an emergency.
Sure. So at some point, the academic institutions around the world will come up with lots of great ideas. What's your plan to operationalize them? Because USAID works with nonprofits and local organizations on the ground in the countries where it operates. And so whatever the universities come up with has to be learned and acted on by those organizations themselves that actually do the work. So do you have a way of making sure that the intellectual property that comes from the colleges translates to what the organizations of USAID actually do?
Yeah, that is a great question. And one of the great things about this proposal is that it actually plugs into the networks and the platforms that all of these aid agencies do. So they're working not only with each other on the academic level, but they're working with specific UN agencies. And that is the example that I cited in Eastern Africa and the failure of the rain season. That is directly working with one of the UN agencies. And part of the academic research and presentation of the findings is taking place on global platforms around anticipatory action, where it's not just the researchers, it is the UN agencies, it is the very large international NGOs who are part of this, as well as USAID and other donors. So it's very much hand in hand with the people who are actually on the ground implementing these initiatives.
And does it translate as far back as the people themselves? For example, better or more modern agricultural techniques that might yield better in a famine or anticipate a famine, or different housing and construction codes for places that have floods, that kind of thing?
Yes, absolutely. Our partners on the ground worked with households directly, you know, training them on different agricultural techniques or working them to make sure they have access to markets for their goods. We work hand in hand with local authorities on building codes or developing policies. We've done a lot of work in working with municipal, state, national governments in developing their emergency response systems, doing training, all of that.
And what about the idea of preparing people in anticipation of, let's say, social or political upheaval? Because some of the most horrible effects we've seen in Africa have been because of what people do to other people, and not droughts and famines and floods and so forth. And is that part of the research?
Right now, it isn't much of it. A lot of the research that is involved in this project has to do with climate change. And a lot of what anticipatory action is based on actions taken on predictable events. And of course, you can predict in many cases disasters that will happen because of state decisions or political conflicts. But in this case, a lot of the work that is being done is natural disasters.
Yes, too bad there's no antidote against the horrible economic decisions of bad leaders around the world. But I guess that's beyond the scope of USAID at this point. And so what is your timeline here? Do you tell each university we need 6 ideas in less than 10,000 words by next October? Or how does this look as a program?
So the topics were already decided. They're already known. Research is already beginning. There are 6 different topics that these 6 universities around the world are leading the research on. And this is a 2-year project. And there are targets for the research to be presented on international fora for peer review and discussion. And again, like I mentioned, these different platforms within the humanitarian community, there will be that feedback and that give and take.
Maggie Schmitz is Acting Division Chief for Private Sector Engagement, Diaspora, and Innovation at the U.S. Agency for International Development. That's part of the Bureau of Humanitarian Assistance. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate the conversation.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA, and today I'm thrilled to be joined by Melissa Bradley, the founder and managing partner at 1863 Ventures, an investment company focused on bridging entrepreneurship and racial equity, and accelerating new majority entrepreneurs from high potential to high growth. Additionally, Melissa is co-founder of Venture-Backed Eureka, a community where small businesses gain unprecedented access to the expertise needed to grow their businesses, and has more than 20 years of entrepreneurship, investment, and leadership experience. Melissa, welcome, and thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Who is the first person that you remember looking up to as a leader, and what was it about them that inspired you?
So there are actually two people. The first person personally was my mom. She was a single parent. And what I realized is that she was the leader of our household, but she was also the leader of our community. She was a staunch advocate for children's rights in public schools, making sure that we got a quality education. She was a staunch advocate around rights for renters. We were not in a financial position that we actually ever owned a home, but she made sure that people who lived in various types of housing, we were in regular housing. The people who were in regular housing, public housing, she made sure that their rights were advocated for, and really just always kind of looked out for, I'll use air quotes, the little guy, although we were the little guy. And then I would say she was a huge advocate of older folks. As part of her job, she worked during the week in a full-time job and then cleaned houses on the weekend, but also took care of elderly folks and a staunch advocate for elderly rights. So that was probably the first leader. And then I would say the second leader that really came about professionally was a woman named Crystal Gaskins, who actually ran a headhunting temporary firm that I ended up spending about a year at, but quickly realized that was not my calling. But in a world where you are constantly managing the powers that be that want to hire all these people and move people around, and the folks who are sometimes in vulnerable positions and obviously seeking a job, she always managed to treat everyone with the ultimate respect. And part of the business was actually managing hotels and getting service workers to show up. And that's a tough job, right? To try to motivate people who barely are getting paid enough under not great conditions. And so she taught me three things. She taught me how to be a motivator, and that recognizing leadership is not mandating, but motivating. She taught me that leadership is not just reporting up, but also reflecting and supporting those who may be underneath you from a hierarchical structure. And she also taught me that leadership was not about money, but it was about producing positive outcomes for whoever your customers were. And if you did that, then obviously the money would come.
How would you describe your leadership style, and how has that developed over the years?
I would describe it hashtag work in progress. It has evolved over the years, I think, two ways. One, the more people I've been exposed to in leadership positions have certainly helped me pivot and make adjustments. And then certainly as my leadership roles have elevated, and probably as the more people I've been responsible for has elevated. Certainly being managing partner and founder of 1863 Ventures, we manage a lot of people. We have actually tripled our staff this year. And so we went from 3 people to 12 people plus and growing. And we went from a couple hundred members to almost 10,000 members. And that's a big deal. So my leadership style has evolved in terms of more people that I have reporting to me. I think it's, I focus on autonomy. I'm very clear that my role is to help other people be successful. I do set very clear deadlines. I try to do a good job of kind of projecting what is the overall mission and vision, what are the KPIs and OKRs that we need to hit. And then I feel like I need to get out the way. I need not be a micromanager. I need to recognize, particularly since COVID, that people have kids, they have lives, they have ways that they know how they perform best. And so we now have people who work for me all over the world. And as long as we meet our deliverables, I don't need to know that you're sitting in a cubicle or sitting at your computer from 9 to 5. And that's because I've been at those 9 to 5 jobs where I literally had nothing to do, but I knew I was told I had to be in the office. And it just seemed like a complete waste of time. And so I'm really laser focused on outcomes and productivity and advancing the vision and mission, and not on what does it look like, because I think a successful work looks different for everyone. And then I would say more externally, as we now have grown to lots of members and we have a social media presence and I talk to people, I'm mindful that the probably the most important from an external perspective about my leadership is that I am mindful that I am modeling, not just for myself, but particularly for other leaders, and particularly Black women and certainly gay Black women. You know, there are not a lot of us. You know, you mentioned that I'm a co-founder of Eureka, so I'm fortunate enough to be in the first 30 or so Black women that have been supported through venture capital, which is a sad statistic, but for a different topic. And so I'm mindful that people are always watching me. And I would say that certainly as a Black woman, people are always watching you, not always for the better and cheering you on, but waiting for you to make a mistake and slip up. And so I'm mindful that when I step into a room or I show up somewhere, I'm not just representing Melissa Bradley and my immediate family. I'm representing all of my members and potentially sending a signal effect of what other people are going to expect as Black women. And the final thing I would say that definitely has evolved since now that I'm over 50 is that I feel a much greater freedom to say what's on my mind than I did before. And I do that. I probably said what was on my mind before, but in a way that was reflective of my frustration and anger with the system. And now I say it with the with the level of calmness and the expectation that it's important that we are honest around what do Black communities experience, and to phrase it in a way not based on anger, but really using data. And so I would say I've consistently been a staunch advocate for Black and Brown communities, but has evolved from being very reactive and saying, well, don't do this and don't do that, to saying, let me explain to you why I think it's important that we take this up, and really letting the facts drive the discussion. Some of that probably comes from the fact that I've worked in two presidential administrations, and we all know that that just goes back and forth and oftentimes based on rhetoric and not fact. And having six kids in a world of social media, I think there's something, the art of conversation based on facts and data has devolved to opinions and pundits. And I think that's a challenge around leadership, because your job is not, in my mind, to convince people, but to inform people and allow them to make decisions for themselves.
I saw you on a post with a Washington Post interview, and you were amazing. And it's interesting to listen to you describe what you just said, because I could see all of that reflected in how you responded there. And make one other quick comment about, as a company grows, WEPA is growing as well. And you are so spot on. We have, as leaders, we have to let go and trust those people that work for us and empower them to do their job and then let them roll. And that's not always easy.